It's Wednesday, April 3rd, 2024, from Peachfish Productions. It's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. The Wall Street Journal notes an alarming trend in Western Hemisphere rhetoric at the very top levels. Latin American diplomacy devolves into schoolyard taunts. Regions' presidents really, really don't like each other, judging from the vitriol flowing on social media. But I have declined thus far to read to you the examples the paper provides in the headline. And one stuck out like a sore thumb. Yes, let's go with thumb. Here it is. Ignoramus, fascist, small penises club. Latin American diplomacy devolves into schoolyard taunts. The small penises accusation flowed from the mouth of Argentina's president, Javier Milei. Taking anatomical aim at the president of Mexico, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, the small penises charge is only referred to once in the journal story. I'll read the quote to you in its entirety. López Obrador, perhaps smarting from when Milei called the Mexican politician supporters the Small Penises Club, entered the latest fray by branding the Argentine a conservative fascist and expressing surprise that Argentines had elected him. Yes, López Obrador, perhaps smarting from that. Yes, perhaps. That is a plausible inference, I would say. But given that this was the extent of the documentation in the journal, I decided to do some digging for you, my listeners. Why specifically this charge, small penises? Well, Milei has been, as it turns out, workshopping the insult for quite a while. We found this podcast from just a few weeks ago where he barges in on another speaker and he issues some proclamations.
Además te cuento, ¿sabías que los zurdos son el club de la pizza corta?
¿Por qué?
Here he says, did you know that leftards, or zurdos, leftists, are the club of the short dick? He goes on and says, long live freedom. But by then, he had worked out the formulation based on the reaction it was getting. Just like Trump started proclaiming, and the Mexicans are going to pay for it, when crowds roared at his references, so too did Milei note the huge reaction his every observation about small penises was earning. Here he is on a earlier video saying envious leftists in what I usually call the short penis club, because basically who claims average penis size, the one with the shortest ones, the one who is above average, is not going to cut it off. Wow, ends with the applause break, as you heard. He was working in hues of transphobia, it would seem, but he saw the reaction it was getting, and he decided to lob it on the international stage, and now it's in a Wall Street Journal headline, presumably moving markets. The journal did quote an exasperated Eric Farnsworth, or perhaps I should say Eric Farnsworth, a former high-ranking State Department diplomat, and Farnsworth said, a lot of it just seems unnecessary, said Farnsworth, vice president of the Council of the Americas Policy Group in Washington. What's the point of this? To which Javier Milei screamed, short penis, Eric says, K? K? For all of Milei's penchant to measure units, the unit of measurement that really matters in Argentina are bond rates, which are proxies for inflation, which he has tamed a little bit. That said, a less than bountiful soy harvest, or as we say in the U.S., an am harvest, could scupper all the work that Milei has put in on the economics front. And then all he'll have is insult humor and the grudging respect of middle school boys everywhere. On the show today, we go full Alberta. Nobody goes full Alberta. Well, we do. Tim Alberta, staff writer for The Atlantic Magazine. In fact, just yesterday won the top honor from the National Magazine Awards for his profile work. We had him on a few weeks ago to talk about the Nikki Haley candidacy. Remember that? Now, Alberta's back to do a full show interview. It's the full Alberta. He's going to talk about Donald Trump's appeal to the community that he, Tim Alberta, grew up in, which is to say evangelical Christians. Tim Alberta, author of The Kingdom, the Power, and the Glory, American Evangelicals in an Age of Extreme, up next.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast,
called PIE, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know.
Trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to. Podcasts on?
Yeah, podcast, homecasts.
Your podcasting apparatus? Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
This episode is brought to you by the Jordan Harbinger Show. You've heard me talk about the Jordan Harbinger Show because it's one of my favorites. He does in-depth interviews with some of the world's most fascinating minds. I can name a few: Barbara Boxer, Anderson Cooper, Michael McFaul, the Ukraine or Russia ambassador talking about Ukraine. One I recently listened to was Stanley McChrystal, the general, the former general, and he told an interesting story about revering Robert E. Lee. But then, after having a portrait of him for 40 years, he's a 63-year-old man, throwing it in the trash. Because his wife says, you know, what that picture and that man means to you, it doesn't mean to other people, and you have to understand that. And then in the interview, they got around to the point where McChrystal talked about that interview in Rolling Stone magazine that pretty much ended his career, where got to the desk of Barack Obama, and it had McChrystal saying unflattering things about the war effort, and just how he talked to his wife and how they decided not to be bitter and not to wallow in it. He could have taken some shots at the process, the reporter, or the president at that point, but he didn't. It was just an overall good interview. It was facilitated by Jordan's excellent interview style. Whether Jordan is conducting an interview or giving advice to a listener, you will find something useful that can apply to your own life in every single episode of the Jordan Harbinger Show. That could mean learning how to ask for advice the right way or discovering a little mindset tweak that changes how you see the world. Search for the Jordan Harbinger Show. That's H-A-R, like the first three letters in hard, B-I-N-G-E, as in how you'll want to catch up on all the episodes on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Tim Albert has been on before, and he's out with a new book. It's called The Kingdom, The Power and the Glory, American Evangelicals in an Age of Extremism. Also get into what he found in reporting on the Christian movement in America, a movement that Tim comes from. Welcome back to The Gist, Tim.
Hey, Mike. Good to see you, man. How are you?
I'm well. And the book, to give you a compliment, is great. It hits on three levels: anthropology, memoir, and just great political reporting. So the memoir part is, give my listeners a sketch of the faith tradition that you grew up in.
Yeah, so I grew up in the Evangelical Presbyterian Church, the EPC, which is, you know, and in a small town, suburbs of Detroit, you know, it's a conservative white Republican town, and it was a conservative white Republican church. And my dad was the pastor. It was a church that was pretty small when we moved there as kids, and kind of a startup church, and then grew and grew and grew, and eventually kind of became a mega church of sorts. And you know, that was my world. That was my subculture. My mom was on staff at the church as well. So I, you know, grew up inside of the church. And it's weird, Mike, it's one of these things where it forms your identity so much that, you know, you are, for better or for worse, like everything you're seeing in the church growing up at an institutional level is forming you. And so there's some really good pieces of that, I think, from some of the people I was around, the lessons, the habits, all of it, the culture. But then there's also some of it that's not so good. There's, you know, you can see, even from a young age, and maybe I was just precocious, but you can see some of the hypocrisy, some of the corruption, some of the grifting. I mean, it's there. And so you're dealing with these dueling impressions of sorts. And then in the backdrop to it, obviously, is just the faith element itself, which for me has always been strong, has never really wavered. And I've always felt confident in my faith, both in the sort of intellectual piece and in being able to defend it. But the church piece of it, the church affiliation, the institutional piece of it, that's where I began to have sort of a crisis as I grew older.
Right. And when we say the church, I mean, that's sort of a synecdoche. But your dad's church, the church that you were in, was a source of comfort. But you would see hypocrisy not there per se, but the Falwells, the Bakers, the larger evangelical movement.
Well, I would actually say both. I mean, honestly, uh-huh. I would say both. It was because I think what you would see at the macro scale was also visible in the micro. And you're, you know, like even just, it's funny, like, you know, if you grew up in this world as I did, you know, just like the focus on the family lesson plans that you would, you know, be looking through as like a middle schooler, as a teenager in high school, like, and you're just kind of spotting these like inconsistencies and some of the stuff that doesn't add up to the adolescent mind as you're trying to find your way in the world. And as you're trying to make sense of like how your upbringing squares with reality around you and how the lessons of scripture that you are taught to hold dear, how you reconcile those with some of the decisions and some of the compromises you see just made every day. And so that's the sort of thing where you're seeing it, you know, in the kind of in the big picture nationally, but you're also seeing it in your own backyard.
So you go away, you establish yourself as an excellent journalist, you warn the country about Donald Trump, you report on the politics of 2016 and upcoming and approaching 2020, and then quite horrifically, suddenly, your father dies, you go back, and you're confronted with what the church has become, which you certainly knew to some extent on an intellectual level, and you'd get reports back from some of the sentiment within the church. But people who you knew as a child and who should be consoling you are in fact using the time of your father's funeral to pick fights with you and calling you a blasphemer, not because of anything to do with God, but to do with Trump. And this must have for you been a lot of things, perhaps horrifying, but also I'm going to guess, and you tell me, clarifying.
Yeah, both horrifying and clarifying, because, you know, in that moment, you're angry and you are hurt, obviously, because you're thinking, I mean, it's a pretty surreal thing to have your dad in a box nearby and your mom crying and your brothers like consoling people, and then to have people in your face wanting to argue about Donald Trump. It's very strange.
On Rush Limbaugh talking points. Yeah.
Yeah. It's just weird. I mean, it's something I'll probably never quite be able to get over. So, yeah, I mean, it's horrifying, but clarifying also in the sense that, you know, a problem that you know exists, maybe I didn't know the scale of it, maybe I didn't know the degree to which it was affecting the church or infecting the church, I should say, mm-hmm. but in that moment, you're starting to put it together and you're realizing, oh boy, this is a serious problem. And not just a serious problem inside the church, Mike, but I think one of the light bulbs that's going off for me at that time is recognizing I had been concerned for a long time about the sort of reputational damage to the church. I mean, when, you know, in my professional circles, you know, evangelical was a punchline, and that's painful because these are people who I love and who I grew up with and who I think the vast majority of them are really good and decent people, and they shouldn't be treated as a caricature. And so I'm concerned about the credibility. I'm concerned about the reputation. And I can see how in a moment like this, you know, if I'm thinking to myself, boy, I'm the pastor's kid who's been here almost my entire life. If they're willing to treat me this way in this moment of great vulnerability, if they're willing to treat me as almost as an enemy, then how are they treating the rest of the world? How are they treating the outside culture that they are called to be evangelizing to? I think in that moment, it just became the immediacy of the problem really overwhelmed me. And that's not to sound dramatic and say like that that day I decided to write the book, but like it certainly set me on the path to trying to investigate the problem and maybe try to offer some sort of a solution.
So motivated reasoning and self-interest are in fact great incentives to tell for all members of our species to tell ourselves any story that works for us. But here you are, perhaps a little foot inside, foot outside, and it's just so clear to you that Trump is not a Christian, a true Christian, does not advance Christian precepts. And all of the people who identify as Christian and were in your church, they're disagreeing as vehemently as possible. And so one of the questions you explore is why. What allows them? First of all, there's the psychological questions of what gets them to this point, but what are their stated reasons? Now, I was intrigued by this, and I read David Brody's book, and there was a lot of talk about Cyrus, that Trump was the biblical figure of Cyrus, where they knew he was imperfect, but he would do the bidding of God's chosen people. I've read a few theological explanations of the work that Trump was doing. Well, first of all, what were they, and were some of these arguments stronger than others, or did you think most of them were just, you know, grasping at some biblical fig leaf to put over what was really going on?
Yeah, that's a pretty good description of it there. I mean, I can remember being in New York City in June of 2016 after Trump had effectively sealed the Republican nomination, and he knew, his campaign knew, that their big vulnerability was in terms of rallying the Republican base around him heading into the general election was with evangelicals. I mean, they had been supporting Ted Cruz overwhelmingly. Those who weren't supporting Cruz were mostly supporting Rubio or Kasich. So Trump had a real problem on his hands. And this was even before he put Pence on the ticket, before he released the list of Supreme Court nominees. This was Trump's first big tactical maneuver to try and shore up evangelical support. So he comes to New York City and he meets with hundreds of pastors and church leaders and evangelical figureheads at the Marriott Marquis Ballroom there. And I came and I reported on it. I spent the whole day there talking with people. And you would get some sort of competing explanations. You would get some of the King Cyrus, God uses unlikely instruments to advance his purposes talk. You would get some people who were actually convinced that Trump really was a Christian and that he was not just an unethical and immoral and imperfect person being used by God, but that he actually really was an unlikely and unknown disciple of Christ who is going to help usher in God's kingdom on earth. You know, you had a few of those people.
The phrase God works in mysterious ways gets a lot of work out too.
A lot of work, very mysterious. But I think the third group, Mike, was the biggest. The third group was just the folks who basically, they walked out of that event, not necessarily any more drawn to Trump than when they walked in, but they did walk out more persuaded that, look, it's a binary choice. Hillary Clinton's going to put two or three pro-choice justices on the court, and we know what she's going to do if elected. We're not totally sure what this guy's going to do, but at least it beats the alternative. He's the lesser of two evils. I mean, that was really the overriding sentiment of the majority of those folks. And through the fall, that continued to be the overriding sentiment. I mean, if you think back to Access Hollywood weekend, it was the same thing. It was, you know, and I spent the entirety really of that election season in that space and talking with these folks. And that was where they just kept coming back to, look, it's binary. It's got to be one of the two of them. And we hope that a transactional relationship with Trump will benefit us. And in many ways it did, right? In many ways it did.
Yeah.
They were right.
They were right. They were right on their most important issue, the abortion issue. As you write, your father was, you know, he had this self-conception that he was almost aborted and his mother changed his mind. He was very motivated by this. I sense, you don't get into it so much. I don't know exactly what your politics on that issue are, but but you are a real Christian. And I understand what real Christians or true Christians think about this. I probably just used the phrase infelicitously and offended someone in my audience. Fine. But yeah, just on the nuts, just on the actual brass tacks of what will happen with abortion under Trump, better outcomes than what will happen with Clinton, they're correct. But there was a whole lot of public justification. Then I also think a lot of private justification to get there, because preachers and many who you talk to and, you know, public figures who are associated with Christianity didn't go to the pulpit on Sunday after Sunday and say, what are you going to do? He's better than the alternative. They came up with a raft of reasons why he's a Christian and he's the righteous instrument of the Lord. And a person like Tim Alberta, who wants to mourn his father, needs to be confronted about this. There's a lot going on there that wasn't just, you know, as Joe Biden says, maybe giving justification to Trump among evangelicals. Don't compare me to the Almighty. Compare me to the alternative. They were literally comparing him to the Almighty.
Yeah, well, and I think, Mike, part of that is I write about this a little bit in the book, and I write about it in the context of my own father. There's, I think, a certain guilt that many serious, mature Christians felt after voting for him. Now, I think specific to the 2016 election, and I try to make this clear in the book, like I do not have fire and brimstone to offer for those Christians who voted for Trump, because I understand that if you are sincerely motivated by the abortion issue and by a narrower set of kind of social issues, then you look at the election and you say, look, as a pragmatic prudential judgment to cast a vote, I'm going to vote for this guy, even though I don't like him, don't trust him, but I do think that possibly he would be better than the alternative. I think a lot of people voted that way. But then I think what happened after that is really interesting at a psychological level, because as Trump takes office and really begins to show his true colors and begins to reveal himself to be someone who is not just carrying himself, behaving, speaking in ways that are consistent with Scripture. He's often carrying himself in ways that are completely antithetical to the biblical standard to which Christians are called. And I think at that point, for a lot of these evangelicals who had backed him somewhat reluctantly, they start to feel this, they start to feel insecure about it. They start to feel a little bit guilty about it. And I think that when the attacks on Trump's character from the media and from the left really start to ramp up in that first year or year and a half of his presidency, I think for people like my dad, they began to very defensively interpret those attacks on Trump's character as ipso facto an attack on their character, because they were the people who put him in office in the first place.
And the evangelical Christian community, people outside it might say, well, what a powerful force in America. The self-conception is that they're beset on all sides and they're an aggrieved minority, and the world, the secular world of America and our big institutions are aligned against them. And Trump plays into that perfectly.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, look, this is why, all the way to present day here, when Trump, I write about this in the epilogue of the book, but like you see this hockey stick in the graphs, the polling data with Trump before he is indicted, and suddenly his numbers, once he's indicted, shoot right back up. In fact, I'm pretty convinced that had Trump never been indicted, that he would not be in this commanding position in the 2024 Republican primary, because after the 2022 midterms, his numbers for the first time in 6 years really began to sink. And he threw pro-lifers onto the bus. He was saying a lot of things that were really provocative to the base. And there was an opening there for DeSantis, for Haley, for others to really take a good chunk out of his support. As soon as Alvin Bragg delivered that first indictment, the numbers started to go right back up, and they've remained on that trajectory. And the reason I say that is just to emphasize the degree to which the persecution complex, the aggrievement that you were just describing a moment ago, this sense of being marginalized and picked on, you know, that gives Trump this superpower where he connects with these people in a way that no other politician can. And when he talks about being their retribution, like, I don't know if you saw this video clip of the pastor in Iowa introducing Trump a few weeks ago, talking about this idea of yeah. kind of righteous retribution. Like, and you see heads nodding all across the ballroom. Like, this is a very potent thing that I'm not sure people outside of the evangelical world truly appreciate.
And we'll be right back with more of Tim Alberta in a moment. And we're back with Tim Alberta, the author of The Kingdom, the Power, and the Glory, American Evangelicals in the Age of Extremism. And my question for Tim in this part of the interview was, are there common critiques that drive evangelicals towards Trump? And if so, I'm going to assume there are. Do you look at those critiques and say, well, you've got to say it. It's fair. Trump is acting immorally or acting illegally, which adds up to immorally. And are there some set of critiques where you say, you know, these aren't really fair or these don't need to be said? And the effect turns out to be to rally potential supporters around him who feel that maybe by proxy they're being attacked when Trump is being attacked.
Well, it's hard because... And I often feel conflicted on this because if you wanted to just keep a running commentary on all the things that Donald Trump says and does that are just objectively immoral or amoral or wrong based on, you know, I'll give a subjective measure here in the spirit of the conversation, but like based on what I learned as a child in Sunday school, like based on the basic distinctions of right and wrong and morality and immorality and what it means to be ethical and full of integrity as a public witness, you know, like Donald Trump every day would be triggering those alarms. The problem is if you are constantly sounding that alarm, then you are doing two things. Number one, you are feeding ammunition to his defenders who say that we're all just hysterical and we're all bedwetting and we have nothing positive to ever say about the man and that we're just out to get him. I think number two, and this is probably more important or more central to the problem that I'm trying to unpack here, many of these folks support Donald Trump in part, Mike, because they believe that the end is near, that the barbarians are at the gates, that they are under siege, and that maybe, just maybe, the only way to ward off this sort of American apocalypse is to find, as Pastor Robert Jeffress once said, kind of the toughest, meanest SOB they can find to go and do this fighting for them. In other words, Donald Trump being a barbarian they're not supporting him in spite of that. Many of them are supporting him because of that. They think that he has this mercenary quality to him where he is unbound by biblical teachings. He is unchained from scriptural etiquette that they as Christians are observant of. And so it's a weird thing to try and explain to people who don't spend time marinating in this messaging of like a cosmic collision between the forces of good and evil. But if you in fact do subscribe to that thinking that this is now, it's not red versus blue, it's not Republican Democrat, it is good versus evil, and that Donald Trump is an ally in that fight, then you start to give him license. You start to approve of tactics to defeat that evil that you would never approve of otherwise. Does that make sense?
It does. And also, there are plenty of biblical examples to reach for where that character, if you wanted to cast David as the son of a bitch who does what it takes, even though his heart was always righteous in the Old Testament, you could. There are plenty of, we could self-justify our way into everything.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And this is where, you know, you mentioned David. I'll just say briefly, not to do like theology 101 here. But what was so interesting to me, and it remains interesting to me, all the way back to 2016 in that Marriott Marquis event, when people would mention David, when they would mention Moses, or they would mention Solomon, and you would kind of dive in, you know, at a doctrinal level a little bit, and talk about repentance. talk about reconciliation, talk about redemption, talk about what it meant to be a flawed character in the eyes of God, but one who was ultimately reconciled to God because they were able to atone for, or they were able to get right with their creator. That, to me, remains the sticking point in the Trump phenomenon, because he has so brashly and unapologetically not only talked about how he doesn't need God's forgiveness, but, you know, just a couple of weeks ago, he's playing this video in Iowa with this voiceover talking about him as a shepherd to all of mankind who will never leave or forsake you. I mean, this is stuff out of like the fever dreams of Jerry Falwell Sr. This idea that someone, that a political leader could be co-opting the language of Christ and be presenting themselves kind of, you know, unabashedly as a messianic figure. And it is so incredibly blasphemous and so incredibly heretical and so offensive to the Christian. And yet the Christian has been now conditioned just to sort of shrug their shoulders and say, oh, well, that's just Trump being Trump.
The evangelicals, many evangelicals casting their lot in with Trump has been great for Trump. Has it been good for them? Has it been good for business?
Well, it's been good for business. You could define what it means to be good for them at a number of different levels. So yeah, I think professionally for a number of these folks whose journeys I document in the book, it's been good for them. And I'm talking about kind of big ticket activist leaders who've been able to pack ballrooms and sell out shows and create media content. Then I'm also talking about a lot of preachers who have turned their Sunday morning worship services into, you know, Fox News segments, and who have like taken a kind of revivalist approach to, you know, turning all things political into all things spiritual, and sort of vice versa. I think where it hasn't been good, Mike, is, listen, at the core of this label, this identification marker of being an evangelical is to evangelize. That is the verb, right? And it's become harder and harder to evangelize to a secular world that looks at you and thinks that you are a bunch of phonies, that you're a bunch of hypocrites, that you're a bunch of political opportunists who were quick to condemn Bill Clinton and his womanizing and Jimmy Carter and his interview with Playboy magazine, but then you jump at the chance to go slumming with Donald Trump. I think, even to the question about abortion from earlier, I think we should be really clear-eyed about this. Like, if you believe, as many really committed Christians I know do, believe that abortion is not a political issue, it's a spiritual issue, it's a religious issue, because life is made in the image of God and it deserves protection, you have now put all of your eggs into the political basket, even though you don't view it as a political issue. And I think you have ceded some moral authority in the process, because you got what you wanted. Roe v. Wade is struck down, and the actual net result of it is more abortion in America, not less, because of this sort of Wild West patchwork of laws and ballot initiatives and everything else that have ensued from the Dobbs decision. And so it's interesting that what seemed to be this triumph for the pro-life movement, actually, now that we have some space to assess it critically, it looks more like a defeat, and not just a defeat in terms of the raw statistics around abortion numbers, but a defeat in terms of public sentiment. You've seen more and more moderate Republicans, never mind independents and Democrats, actually become much more progressive on the abortion issue just in the last 5 years. And I have to think, Mike, that some of the reason for that is because people are looking at the evangelical subculture and their supposed value set and their attachment to the true and sincere convictions around an issue like abortion, and yet at the same time they see the trade-offs and the moral compromises made in the process and the Faustian bargain. And I think the credibility of their witness becomes diminished in the process. I mean, so has it been good for them on the whole? I think no. I think it's actually been really harmful for them.
I agree, but when we speak of abortion in the political context, so I don't engage that much with media that talks about abortion outside the political context, I don't think. But when we talk about it inside the political context, what you say, I think it cuts the other way too, because Bill Clinton and his phrasing of safe, legal, and rare, or Democrats who were in favor of legalized abortion would often point out, but look at the actual number of abortions under our administration because we have better social conditions or sort of pregnancy counseling or contraception. They've gone down. No, to my understanding of things, no one ever cared about that argument. No one ever voted on that argument. No one who identified themselves as pro-life ever said, well, abortions are down under Bill Clinton. They just knew that he was in favor of legal abortion, so they were against that stance of his.
Yeah, no, I think that's true. But now, you know, we're in a brave new world here where there's, you know, you talk to pro-life activists and there's this sense of, okay, like the dog caught the car and now what? I mean, I live in Michigan where up until a couple of years ago, abortion was relatively tightly regulated. And now Michigan is one of many states that has basically just thrown the doors open and there's very little restriction, very little regulation on abortion now. And I think that is, you know, talk about sort of unintended consequences. Again, I hate to belabor this point, Mike, it's just important to me because I have family and friends and people who are deeply committed to the pro-life cause. And I think that they have been betrayed by the exercise of raw and the pursuit of raw political power here rather than the pursuit of compassion and persuasion and sincere, holistic work done to advance their cause and to prove out the arguments about the dignity of human life. I mean, listen, it's when the message of that is hard to get across when Donald Trump and Herschel Walker are your messengers, right? It doesn't sell.
Yes, the dignity candidates. So here's my last question. I'll start with this observation. This entire book would be interesting from a biographical, sociological perspective if the word Trump weren't in it. I'm just curious about you. You swapped out, and not just because of Trump, but you swapped out one belief system, or really one subculture, which was the evangelical church, for another, which is, you know, you work for The Atlantic and write books and are on the Axe Files and The Gist and so forth. You're also on Christian shows. I don't know if that day of your father's funeral, if among your many reactions was, this is a demarcation and this part of my life or this part of my world is done. But my question is, the tribe that you're now affiliated with, does it give you as much sustenance as the tribe of being part of that evangelical community? I know that you turn to your wife, you turn to your close family members for that. But in general, we're social animals and we also look to the people we associate with. So that is my question. When you've subbed out your professional tribe for your spiritual tribe, is it servicing the same needs for you as a person?
Well, if I was just relying on my professional identity and my professional community, then it wouldn't satisfy those needs. But you know, I've been to the premise there, Mike. I've been really fortunate that despite some of the ugliness and the unpleasantness, to put it mildly, that I've experienced in the church, both in my church and in the church, sort of more globally, that I have not been frightened away from Christ, and I haven't even been frightened away from organized religion. I mean, you know, we're members of a really good, solid church where we have a great community, where we have great friends and great leaders and great pastors and people who are able to disciple us and walk with us and to help us grow in our faith, my wife and my sons and I. And also, I think, You know, it's interesting. I've never thought of, and I swear I'm not being corny when I say this, it's the truth. I've never thought of my professional identity as being in conflict with my religious identity, in part because I think both in being a Christian and in being a reporter, you are called to pursue truth. I think that there are very few callings. Tell me if you disagree on this. And again, I'm not trying to be corny. I think there are very few careers that are actually callings. You know, my dad was fortunate enough to have one as being a guy who was an atheist who was in finance and kind of a hotshot New York banker to suddenly be called into the calling to preach the gospel was a crazy, dramatic, unlikely thing that happened in his life. And that was a calling. Journalism, to me, particularly in this very treacherous, perilous moment in American life, does feel like a calling for me. And so I do feel like, both as a Christian and as a journalist, as I pursue truth and as I prize truth and cling to truth in a moment of great, you know, distortion, deception, misinformation, that I find meaning both as a Christian and as a journalist. And that is sort of above and beyond just my own core religious practices as a Christian. Does that make sense?
It does. And I mean, this just may be me, but I'm always talking about the debates about objectivity. And I understand that it's imperfect, right? It's a belief, it's a North Star. But to me, this idea that journalism needs to become something other than the pursuit of the truth, it needs to start primarily questioning what is truth. There are analogies to the breakdown of a spiritual institution like the church. You question yourself so much. What's really going on here? An improvement in the institution or self-justification to get to the answer that you want?
Man, that's its own podcast, and you're opening
several podcasts. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a series. It's a, you're onto something though. And look, if I can just proselytize for a moment, I'm just unapologetic about this, Mike. I mean, it's I believe that if you, as a Christian, if you are a Christian listening to this, or if you're not, but one day, who knows, you have some crazy experience that leads you down that road and you start to explore who is Jesus and what does the Bible actually teach and who am I in relationship to my Creator? I just believe that the answers to those questions are found in Scripture, and I believe that my identity is found in Scripture. And when you have that sort of a foundation for truth and for identity, I use that word very deliberately because I think that really the crisis we're living through in the American church and in American society more broadly is a crisis of identity. I think people have gotten really overly invested and to some degree completely lost in these sort of tribal identities, tribal affiliations that have created this zero sum, us versus them, you know, one side must conquer the other mentality. And we have forgotten to love our neighbor. We have forgotten to turn the other cheek. We have forgotten how to show grace and compassion and forgiveness to those who need it. And I think that's at the core of our problem here. And for me, you don't have to necessarily find those things in Scripture. But for me, as a Christian, that is where I start. And that is what informs my approach to all of this.
Tim Alberta is a reporter for The Atlantic, and his book is The Kingdom, the Power, and the Glory, American Evangelicals in an Age of Extremism. Thank you, Tim.
Yeah, Mike, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That's it for today's show. The Gist is produced by Corey Wara. The senior producer is Joel Patterson. Michelle Pesca is CLO of Peachfish Productions. The Gist is presented in collaboration with Libsyn's AdvertiseCast. For advertising inquiries, go to advertisecast.com/thegist. Umpru, gpru, dupru, and thanks for listening.